My name is Ana Del Rey. I'm from the University of Ottawa. This is the first time I get to say that. It's really exciting. And I am your chair today for the panel, working class one, class of DF, armed with speakers, lower risk, Amelia from DF, and Christina Valito. So it's going to be quite normal, a 20-minute talk, and then a 10-minute question and answer period. I'm going to present each of the presenters one by one. First, we have Laura Risk. A PhD candidate in the Music College at McGill University and a Vanier Canada graduate scholar. Congratulations. She's the co-author of the Glengarry Collection, the Highland Fiddle Music of Angus Grant, and previously directed the Fiddle Heads Ensemble at Wellesley College. Her research interests include the traditional instrumental musics of Quebec and Scotland, the mechanics of musical transmission, the intersection of musical genre and practice, and alternative approaches to writing musical biography. As a professional fiddler, she has toured and recorded as a soloist and with various bands, produced 6 albums, and taught at workshops and summer schools across America. Her paper today is called Popwood Fiddle Music and Popular Song, A Woman's Voice in the Musical and Lumbering Economies of Quebec's Gaspé Peninsula. Laura.
And I said I'm a fiddle player, and but I'm not a grad student. And in 2010, I was invited to perform at a small festival, Douglastown Irish Week, which celebrates the Irish heritage of a village, Douglastown, at the tip of Quebec's Gaspé Peninsula. And among the musicians that I met in Douglastown was a 70-year-old woman, Norma MacDonald, if she is in front of her house, who sings and plays guitar and is learning to play the fiddle. Now, I should say, although language issues are largely beyond the scope of this paper, Douglastown was, until recently, primarily English-speaking. The first settlers of the town who arrived in the 1780s were loyalists, and there were also a large number of Irish immigrants in the 19th century. However, Douglastown is now primarily francophone, and it's becoming something of a bedroom community for Gaspé, which is only about 20 kilometers up the road. So Norma MacDonald is a musical mainstay of her community. She directs the church choir, she plays at the long-term care facility in Gaspé, and she MCs the open stage on the last afternoon of Irish Week, among many other musical activities. And over the years, she's held a variety of jobs, including driving a taxi, working as a cook and a stripper at Dixie Lee, which is a fast food chicken restaurant in Gaspé, and cooking lunches for primary school students. She's also the mother of 7 children. But in this paper, I'll be focusing on her work as the housekeeper and business assistant for a local pulpwood contractor whose name was William MacDonald. And this is, if we look specifically at the period from 1962 to 1964. This is William's house. It's next door to Norma's house, or to where Norma is now. So this is how Norma described this work to me when we spoke, the first time we spoke in 2010. She said, "I work for this neighbor over here, and he had fiddlers come in. I get my guitar and accompany them. He liked the violin. He used to lilt tunes to sing the tunes. And if someone came in, a good dancer, that couldn't play the fiddle, William would sit up and lilt, and they would step dance. He used to buy pulpwood. Everyone coming in his house were all coming to get paid for their wood that they cut. Sometimes James Henry Connolly, who's a local fiddler, would come out and visit. William would always ask him, 'Now you have to come out and play the violin for me if I pay you for your wood.' And he'd come and play for him." I think the scarcity of written records regarding informal music making in Quebec is itself reason enough to document the music at William MacDonald's house. But I would argue that examining these particular musical gatherings may also broaden our understanding of how what we now call traditional music was made and how it was represented in the 20th century. As Richard Handler has noted, the cultural objectification of folk music and dance practices in Quebec, that is, seeing culture as a thing made up of objects and entities, dates back well into the 19th century. The archives are full of literary, folkloric, and artistic representations of fiddling and dancing in Quebec. Just a very small sampling here. From the 1880s, we have these romanticized descriptions. Say here, this is the step dancing cook in the lumber camp. Let you do that. We also have village weddings, poetic representations. In the late 1910s and in the 1920s, we find various stagings of traditional veillées. So these are both folkloric and commercial. There's, of course, Maurice Barbeau's Veillée de Bon Vieux in Montreal. There's also Conrad Gautier's series of the same name, which is the Monument National. There's a picture from that. There's the Soirée de Bon Vieux in Quebec City, so on. In the 1940s, actually from 1945 to 1947, the music magazine Passetemps, which tended to focus more on classical music. They had this one series of covers that were illustrated with seems to be forms of everyday music making. So they had children practicing at home and birds singing. And they had a couple covers with representations of traditional music and dance, and also maple syrup making. And also in April 1964, you find a Quebec tourist branch advertisement. This one right here. Down here you can see the dancers and the fiddler. And you can't really read the caption, I know what it says. There's folklore galore to see and enjoy in Quebec's quaint fishing villages, the country veillées. You call them podiums. Of course, there are also various recorded radio and television veillées and the representations of this music from the Soucy family recordings of the 50s and to Don Messer's televised representations and later Soirée Canadienne. So these sorts of literary, folkloric, and commercial stagings of music and dance can function and continue to function in dialogue with music and dance practice. Folklorists, writers, and illustrators choose certain types of rural musical gatherings to celebrate, elevate, and sometimes caricature. Professional musicians and radio and television producers then adopt or challenge that imagery to sell their music. But Douglastown is the latecomer to this game. In Quebec, as Handler notes, folklore studies, because, quote, folklore studies have always been conditioned by the defensive stance of French-Canadian nationalists, which means that the staging of an Anglophone Irish-identified community is a bit of a hard sell. However, Douglastown has recently begun staging itself. There's the Irish Week festivities, there's also an extensive local oral history project, and there's a planned archival CD and website. And I've actually been involved in all of these projects to one degree or another. I've performed at Irish Week, I've assisted with some of the oral history interviews, and I'm also part of a very small team working with the Douglastown Community Center on the CD and the website. Now go back to William McDonald's. The music making at William McDonald's house was not a staging intended for public consumption, although much of the repertoire that was played can be traced to commercially popular sources. So in writing this paper, I feel that I've actually taken on the task of, in a way, staging this music, of representing it, this music, these musicians, and this place to a public, well, to you, today. I mean, in essence, I'm culturally objectifying certain elements of everyday life in Douglastown in the 1960s. I've been debating if there's anything wrong with this. I'm not sure yet. But it seems to me that cultural objectification is actually how our society creates patrimony. And this paper derives in part from my work in helping Douglastown stage itself, to determine their patrimony and stage it. But I also see this project as part of that long continuum of Quebecois musical representation with the various images. And as such, I would like to contribute to that dialogue a different model of music making than what we tend to have in the representations. So a model that is more community-based, but is also linked to local economic forces, and one that includes both men and women musicians, that crosses language lines, and that mixes older fiddle, dance, and song repertoire with newer, popular, and country favorites. So now, what kind of music happened at this house in the 60s? So first I'll start by placing it in some sort of economic context. Canada has been a major player in the pulp and paper industry since the early 20th century. And in the post-World War II economic boom, the industry was at a high point with the surge of expansion in the 60s. Wood cut near Douglastown went south to Chandler Mill, which was owned by Gaspasia, which is a subsidiary of Price Brothers, which later became B2B Price. By the early 1960s, the mill's output was primarily newsprint, and most of it went to the New York Times, and they actually owned like a 49% share of the mill in the company. So rather than wintering at isolated lumber camps, most Douglastown men cut pulpwood locally in the 1960s. Although there were a few lumber camps in the area, there's like a Howard Smith camp near Haldimand, which is right up the road. So Brian McDonald, who's Norma's husband, a great picture of him demonstrating his old scythe for me. He began cutting pulpwood at the age of 9, and he described what it was like to be one of these woodcutters. He said to me, "We used to do that in the summers. Instead of playing, we'd go in the woods. That was the main thing putting around here. There were games and games in the woods." So he started cutting in the summers when he was 9, but most of the cutting was actually in the winter. Men who are older than 9. He said, "Games and games in the woods, in the wintertime especially. Every place was locked or somebody was cutting." When Brian was older and working seasonally for the Minister of Transport, he still spent his winters cutting wood with his father. And I have some pictures, which unfortunately are not found, and they're quite a bit earlier, but I think they do give a bit of the sense of what this might have been like. These are from the Forestry Society, great online resource. So Brian said, "My winters were the best time, economically, in terms of his income, better than I think than the Ministry of Transport, perhaps equal. So me and my father in the woods with the horse, for working around here, that was as good a job as any." His own sons began cutting wood in the winter as teenagers. And Brian remembers that he says they'd cut some and then William McDonald would come and scale it and measure it. And then they were well done for their weekend, they'd have money. This is actually a fairly local picture, only 10 years earlier than the time I was speaking about. This is right, the river, one of the rivers that comes out. So as a pulpwood contractor, William McDonald bought cut wood from individuals like Brian, and he shipped it by train and truck to the Chandler Mill. He also hired small groups of men to cut wood on public land under contract with the government. During the week, William would be out scaling or measuring cut lumber, and on Fridays and Saturdays, men would come to his house to be paid for the wood that they cut. So William McDonald first hired Norma Gall, that's her maiden name, in 1962. She says, "He came down one night. He was cousin to my mother, and he used to visit her, and they would sing a song together. His wife wasn't well, and he asked me to come and work there at his house." And you could see, actually, that Norma and William were both in the church, not in the Douglastown choir around this time, too, of singing. Norma started working for William the next day after he asked her. And she helped around the house, took care of the couple's 4 children. And also living in this house was William's bedridden mother, who passed away the following year. Norma describes herself as a livid maid for these 2 years, and after which she left to marry Brian McDonald, who lived nearby and was William's cousin in the small town. William rehired Norma in the early 1980s after his wife had died, and she worked for him for another 15 years then, but in this paper I'm really focusing on her first stint in his house, which was the early 60s. So Norma remembers herself as a jack of all trades. She says, "I was doing everything, driving trucks, taking them in the woods to meet the boss, and he would check out the wood, the work that was being done. I used to milk the cow, pick up the eggs, feed the hens, clean out the barn, make homemade butter and homemade bread." Now, William was a strong singer, a good dance caller, and he loved music and dance, particularly fiddle music. When men would arrive for their paychecks, William would ask, "Do you play the violin?" And Norma would often accompany these fiddlers on the guitar. In later years, William would ask Norma to fetch an old violin that her husband had inherited for fiddlers who would come to get paid and didn't have their instrument with them. She would go next door and get a violin. So I've been trying to piece together lists of players and repertoire at William McDonald's house in the early 60s. Fiddlers James Henry Connolly, Gerard Durrett, and Ralph Lucas all cut wood for William. Though not Joe Howell, who worked for the federal government. Joe Howell and James Henry Connolly also often visited to play for William's bedridden mother. As Norma recalls William's mother, she says, "She was all curled up in the bed, and that was how they treated her to fiddle music, because she loved fiddle music." Step dancer Douglas Baird had machinery, trucks and loaders and blowers, which he would contract out. He would contract out his labor to William. And when he danced, Norma remembers, he was light on the floor, she says. Joe Girard drove a truck for William, and he also cut wood. Norma says, he'd come to get paid, and then William would say, "Now you're going to dance a tune." William would start stamping his feet. He would do that, what we think of as a very characteristic French-Canadian foot tapping move. He'd start stamping his feet, and Joe Girard, after working hard loads all week, would get up and make the nicest steps over there in the kitchen, just like that, and they were satisfied then. Georgia particularly liked dancing to William's lilting of St. Anne's Reel and the Old Man and the Old Woman. Dick Hatch was a doctor. He and his wife Annette lived in the United States, but they would visit William when they were in Douglastown. She was from Douglastown, and her brother cut wood for William. Dick Hatch would play William's pump organ and sing, and Norma would play guitar. And Dick Hatch's repertoire was primarily Irish songs, but they done some what they call Irish songs. These are Irish-themed vaudeville or music hall songs. But he also often sang Jamaica Farewell. And these gatherings frequently included Everard Coole, who was Dick Hatch's brother-in-law and a local amateur violinmaker. Now, Reggie Booney did not work for William, but he would come to house parties there, and he always ended the evening singing the country song My Old Pal, heard by Jimmy Rogers. Graham MacDonald, William's brother, was also a fine singer, and Norma remembers accompanying both men on a guitar. So we could listen to a little bit of this. Here's James Henry Connolly. Everybody, when you ask James Henry people about James Henry Connolly, the first thing I would say is he used to hum. He would play and he would hum. You'll hear that. Oh, hold on. Economic rationale, which was getting paid. onto their music. Third, this music making was embedded in an incredibly rich local musical culture. William MacDonald loved the fiddle, but in his Douglastown that was by no means unusual. And to explore this topic for this, really beyond the scope of this paper, although Glenn Patterson, who's at the Moore University, is doing some really interesting work on this. But I'll just say for the moment that fiddle music and Stephians had great effective power in Douglastown, and they still do, even though there's very little of either one of either practice left. And I think this effective power is linked to both sound, repertoire and style, and also to certain physical places. In fact, Douglastowners tend to describe the former musical life of their village as a set of places. They talk about fiddler Joe Drowdy's kitchen, or certain summertime picnic dances in the woods. And then those places are themselves linked to certain people and foods
and repertoire.
Fourth and last, these players were not staging anything for anyone. They were businessmen, seasonal woodcutters, tractor and truck drivers, a government worker, a doctor, and a live-in maid who, when they met, not all at once, but in small configurations, played, sang, and danced the repertoire that they knew well and then appealed to them. And in this context, fiddle tunes, Irish songs, Jamaica Farewell, and My Old Pal, all carried more or less the same symbolic value. Douglastown, however, has changed. The local pulpwood industry has collapsed. There are no more independent contractors like William MacDonald. The local dance hall scene is gone, as is the annual St. Patrick's show. If there is any economic force now driving local music making, it's probably Irish Week. Over the past 3 years, the festival has moved away from a primarily Irish-oriented program towards one that increasingly centers attention on local Douglastown music, and I will claim some responsibility for encouraging the festival to move in that direction. Last year, the program featured an evening concert by three siblings of Norma's generation, so fiddlers Joseph and Anthony Drowdy and their guitar player sister, Bridget. And this year, the organizer is hoping, it's not certain, to feature their cousin and Douglastown's last local fiddler, Ernest Drowdy. I think Douglastown has begun to realize that its music has potential as what Mark Slovin calls a heritage music, a present-day cultural production that references the past. Douglastown has a wealth of imagery to choose from, summer picnic dances, winter house parties, St. Patrick's Day celebrations, and these intimate gatherings at William MacDonald's house. How the festival will choose to stage Douglastown's past, and how the community center, which runs the festival, will stage Douglastown in these larger projects, the oral history, the archives, the CD, and how successful Douglastown will be both in attracting the public and in reviving local interest in music and dance are all questions that have to wait at least until the first week of August. So I hope to see you there, if nothing else is going on. Thank you.
Thanks for your paper. I just have a question about the recordings that you had.
As I said, I'm working with the community center on this archival CD project. So those are recordings that I have access to through that project. Except that, the recording of Norman lilting the tunes was during one of our interviews. That was 2010, that recording. The James Henry Connolly and Gerard Durrett, do them one at a time. Gerard Durrett is still alive and plays a little bit. He's quite elderly and not in great health. But he was quite well known as a local fiddler and actually played at many dances, events, other old home week, these sorts of things, not in Douglastown, but locally, in contests and things like that. And at one point, he made a recording, a cassette. I think it was just in his living room, but then he duplicated it and it was available for sale. So that recording is from that.
And it's in the archives?
Well, the archives are not available yet, but when the archives become available, probably some of it, yes. Often the situation with Douglastown. What I have right now is a copy. But I'm hoping to get maybe a first generation copy of that eventually. James Henry Connolly I got that recording through the community center. They've been doing a fantastic job of collecting oral histories and asking people for any recordings that they have of the song and the dance. People, there was an incredibly active recording culture in this village. Partly, I think, because there was so much out-migration. So people would record fiddlers and singers, and then they would make 10 copies, and then they would send those to their relatives who moved to Montreal or to Ontario or to the States. And then they would make copies, and they would make mixtapes. This was, you know, there's, so often what you get is, I don't know how many generations of recording. But so that James Henry Connolly, someone had a recording of, actually that one I think was, that was this one local man who had the foresight to buy a reel-to-reel recorder in the 60s and went around and recorded all of his neighbors. Unfortunately, the original reels are lost, but they're cassette copies of these reels. Well, yes, I have digital copies of somebody's cassette copy of that, but we don't have the original reels. They've disappeared. They went into the basement. Well, we're doing our best.
Thank you.
Heather, you have a
question? Yeah, I'm just really interested in how this compares to other lumbering communities. And so I'm just wondering, am I understanding that there weren't lumber camps where people would be camping and staying, and then, because of course that would be so much where the music and the dance would be circulating, and I'm just curious if there is that interaction, and also, so are there not people, because you just talked a lot about out-migration, so are there not a lot of people coming into the community to do lumbering and then bringing music and repertoire and playing stuff?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question, because this is something this is, I think, why I started this particular project, is when Norma was telling me about this pulpwood connection and her involvement. There was this sort of cognitive dissonance in my mind with how I thought lumber and music were linked in Quebec, which was this lumber camp image, which is very much about men. The image, I think, is that men leave their communities. They go to an isolated location, and they are themselves from various communities. They all come together in this isolated location. They cut wood all day, and then they play music at night, and then they go back, and they bring their music back. That definitely happened. I mean, I know fiddlers who had that experience, although it's not clear to me how much music was going on. It depends on the lumber capacity. In Douglastown, I mean, part of this is that this is a slightly later period, so this is the 60s. There were lumber camps around Douglastown earlier, and Brian McDonald talks about, so this is pulpwood, he talks about the long lumber days, which would be longer, like 8-foot long, this is a 4-foot long, and that there would be lumber camps. But even then, actually, it sounds like in this area, the lumber camps were not that far from the village. Like his father, so this is probably early 20th century, his father, one of his jobs would be to take supplies out to the lumber camp on horse and then bring them back. So this was not like, there's that movie, that film, O&F film, Boucheron de Menouin in the early 60s, it's like very isolated lumber camp, it takes 3 days to get there or something. And that's not what was going on here. I think, there were. I think at this time there were still some lumber camps in the area, like Brian does mention this one, but that had definitely decreased in importance. It was more this local, very much a part-time job. It's something that I'm still trying to sort out, that connection between the music and the wood, because lumber was such an important part of the industry. Of the economic life, the lumber industry was such an important part of the economic life of Quebec and of Canada for so long, and we do connect it with the music. But I think I think there's other elements to it than just men going off playing music together and then returning home, and that's part of what I'm trying to get at here. There's some interesting work about women in New Brunswick lumber camps. I don't know anything about women in Vancouver camps, but not about the music though, just working at a public camp, so.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
So then, aside from these private music making opportunities, where were people playing together then?
Oh yeah, there were dances, and at some points there were two dances a week. I mean, there was a dance Douglastown. They didn't have a dance hall, but there was a couple that would come up and like run dances during the summer. Then there were dance halls in three or four local communities, very, very close by. And the Douglastowners would often go to those. There's also some religious issues. They were mostly Catholic. They weren't supposed to go to Protestant halls, but they would go. They weren't supposed to tell the priest, and so on. There was a lot of music making in people's homes. In the summertime, they would set up platforms out in the woods and have, they're called picnic dances. Ernest Drowdy, the last living fiddler in Douglastown, unfortunately, hate to say that, he has very strong memories of his father, who's a fiddler, being woken up at about 2 in the morning by, like there would be a gang of, late teens and early 20s who would have gone to the dance hall and then hadn't had enough, so then they would come back to the village and they would make the rounds of all the fiddler's houses and they would knock on the door and they'd come in and wake up the fiddler and he would come down to the kitchen and play for about an hour and they'd do a dance in the kitchen and they'd go off to the next fiddler's house. So there's a huge, the oral history of this music dance culture is incredible. Right up, I'd say, through the 70s, to the 80s. This is an infinitesimal part of it. I think what attracted me to this is that it is so linked with the pulpwood industry, whereas much of the other music and dance was very much just a social event, and it didn't have this economic connection. That makes sense.
Don't have time for another question. I'm sorry if you want to speak to Laura. Please do after during lunch. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you.